is Taking Aim with
Rav Shonman
and Maya Shon, coming to you Tuesday, October 4th, 2005. It was an extrajudicial execution, said Amnesty International. A political assassination, said Grandma. FBI terror attack in Puerto Rico. Snipers gunned down independence hero, provoking anti-colonial outcry. On September 23rd, as hundreds of workers and their families participated in the annual pro-independence commemoration known as El Grito de Laras, the Cry of Laras, agents of the Federal Bureau of Investigation, some 100 agents, with helicopters above, descended on the town of Hormigueros in southwestern Puerto Rico and assassinated, murdered, Puerto Rican liberation hero Filiberto Ojeda Rios, leader of the Machicheros. Today on Taking Aim, execution in Puerto Rico, the signature of U.S. rule. Ralph?
Amnesty International, in designating this an extrajudicial execution, also made the point that this was not the first. And as many have reported, the very nature of colonial occupation and subjugation of the Puerto Rican people has been characterized by a series of extrajudicial executions. Indeed, in 1934, U.S.-trained Puerto Rican snipers killed two nationalist activists. And during the Ponce massacre of 1937, the Puerto Rican National Guard, again under FBI direction, fired on a pro-independence demonstration that was simply demonstrating to demand freedom for political prisoners. 21 people were killed and 200 were wounded. The act designated as a massacre by the American Civil Liberties Union that was present at the time. In 1950, U.S. Air Force jets bombed a rural town and killed and wounded hundreds of people. Throughout the 1970s, independistas were murdered randomly, hunted down, including two who were bombed while having dinner in a restaurant. And in 1978, two college students, independistas, were lured into joining an FBI false flag operation, a fake guerrilla group, which was in fact FBI operatives, who induced these two youngsters to go with them and then ambushed and murdered them in a mountain called Sierra Maravilla. And in 1979, an independence leader serving a six-month sentence for being part of a nonviolent civil disobedience occupation of U.S. Navy land on Vieques was murdered in his Florida prison cell. The execution of Filiberto Ojeda Rios is part of a long tradition of official murder in Puerto Rico.
Let's look at the events of the assassination of Filiberto Ojeda Rios. As his wife, Elma Beatriz Rosado Barbosa, testified at a press conference a Monday after the Friday assassination, quote, on Friday, September 23rd, in the afternoon hours, our house was surrounded. Armed men penetrated our property and took our house by assault, hitting it in a brutal and terrible manner, firing with heavy weapons against the front wall of our residence. A neighbor, Hector Reyes, whose house is approximately 300 feet from that of Ojeda Rios, who was living incognito as Don Luis, a man who planted roses and other tropical plants, because Ojeda Rios had been on the lam for over 15 years, and we'll go into that shortly. But Hector Reyes confirmed that the U.S. assault team began firing on the house as soon as helicopters arrived on the scene. Quote, the first shots were very powerful, not from a little revolver like the FBI said Reyes. And that is referring to the FBI statements that they fired in self-defense, that in fact Ojeda Rios had opened his door, fired at them, and that they returned fire. 100 shots were found. The spent cartridges were found that had been fired by the FBI with powerful guns. And in fact, a sharpshooter had targeted Reyes. Reyes, on the other hand, returned fire, with 10 spent bullets were found from a small revolver. And as the neighbor, Ojeda Rios had 10 spent bullets. But as Reyes and the wife, Elma Beatriz Rosado Barbosa, and also any physical evidence that was found at the site afterwards by the Puerto Rican government demonstrated this was a targeted assassination by the FBI. Let's look much more closely at this targeted assassination and the autopsy that was completed on Ojeda Rios, which showed that the FBI intended to murder him, assassinate him, and not capture him. Ralph?
Ojeda Rios was alone with his wife in their home. At least, according to the BBC and other bourgeois reports, at least 100 armed agents were involved, backed by helicopter attack ships and a squad of military sharpshooters that had been brought to the island from Virginia. Ojeda Rios was actually struck by a sniper shot from a high promontory, a high-powered rifle. He did not suffer a wound in any vital organ. It was a wound to the shoulder that passed through the lung, and he was left to bleed to death on the floor of his home. Not merely that, the FBI specifically blocked, cordoned off the area, and refused all Puerto Rican authorities and emergency medical teams to gain access to the perimeter. They maintained a militarized perimeter for 24 hours. They later attempted to present a fake story about how they had responded only after he had opened fire on them, which was completely belied by the testimony of Elma Beatriz Rosado Barbosa, who described how the armed men had penetrated the property, taken the house by assault, hitting it, quote, in a brutal and terrible manner, firing with automatic and heavy weapons from all directions against the front wall of the residence. And indeed, the neighbor Hector Reyes, who you describe, who was approximately 300 feet, confirmed this account in particulars and detail.
Ralph, aside from the 100 FBI agents, the FBI were assisted by 300 of a special group of Puerto Rican police. Yet the governor and high officials, as well as the local officials in Hormigueros, did not know of this action. And the FBI had been monitoring the house of Ojeda Rios for over 4 days. 4 days. Now, the date of the assault, Friday, September 23rd, as we noted, is an important historic date. And in fact, as the FBI was assaulting Ojeda Rios' home in the small town of Hormigueros, where hundreds of people had been gathered to commemorate El Grito de Lares, the 137-year-old failed revolutionary attempt against the Spanish colonial rule that took place in 1868. It was at 3 p.m. on that day that the crowd was listening, nonetheless, to a recorded message from Filiberto Ojeda Rios. In fact, Ojeda Rios is the leader of the Boricua Popular Army, the Macheteros, the machete wielders.
Or the cane cutters.
Or called the cane cutters. And every year he sends a recorded message to the Lares celebration because he cannot go there and speak in person. As I mentioned, he had been living incognito as Don Luis, and the people in the town didn't realize that Don Luis was in fact Ojeda Rios, the well-respected, well-renowned, and loved leader of the Los Macheteros. The reason we say that the FBI had intended to assassinate Ojeda Rios and not capture him came out because of the overwhelming response, the popular response that forced the governor of Puerto Rico to allow Dr. Hector Pesquera, who's a president of another pro-independence group, the Justiniano Independence Movement. And as a doctor, he was allowed to participate, to watch the autopsy of Ojeda Rios. Now, this is an autopsy that was delayed because the FBI did not allow any medical help or any of the local police or prosecutors from the town to come onto the site. They kept, as Ralph mentioned, a militarized cordon around the site for almost 24 hours. And the autopsy, which took place at the San Juan Institute of Forensic Sciences, was witnessed by Dr. Jesca Pesquera, and this is what he stated. They did not come to arrest Filiberto Ojeda. They came to kill him. He did not die instantaneously. What I saw as a doctor is that they let him bleed to death. There was a considerable time in which he was wounded, and he did not receive the aid that could have saved his life. Now, the Puerto Rican Justice Secretary, Roberto Sanchez Ramos, also concluded. He stated, if Mr. Ojeda had received immediate medical attention after being shot, he would have survived.
Well, Maya, this is prototypical of the way the murder authorities in the United States, the counterterrorism squads, the FBI, the CIA assassination units, conduct their affairs. When they target somebody, to give some very specific examples, the execution of Malcolm X by FBI operatives who had penetrated the Nation of Islam is featured by a particular event. Namely, that as Malcolm lay dying on the floor, the man who gave him mouth-to-mouth resuscitation was in fact an FBI operative. And indeed, they made sure that Malcolm did not survive, and so they did with Lee Harvey Oswald when he was gunned down by Jack Ruby. He was killed, in fact, in the ambulance taking him away. The murder of Ojeda Rios was a calculated execution. This was a 70-year-old man with a heart condition and a pacemaker. He was certainly not a figure who they had any concerns about being able to hold off hundreds of armed guards. This was an execution. And indeed, the Puerto Rican Truth and Justice Commission stated on the 25th of September, the FBI execution of revolutionary leader Filiberto Ojeda Rios 2 days earlier is without any doubt a political assassination. But throughout our history, the FBI has been a tool of political police repression of the Puerto Rican independence movement. During the repression against the nationalist movement during the 1930s, the 40s, and the 50s, the statement continues, the FBI was instrumental in keeping files on and persecuting the Puerto Rican nationalist movement. It was responsible for creating the Police Intelligence Division, an organization for the persecution and repression of independence movement and any of those who sympathized with it, freeing itself of the dirty work and the illegal activities for special assigned murderous hands. The hand of the FBI was present in all of this, whether in conspiring, covering up, turning a blind eye to the events, or orchestrating them. The commission gives a series of examples of in the history of the Puerto Rican struggle for national independence. The case of the murder of Santiago Chagui, Marie Pesquera, son of independence movement leader Juan Marie Bras, the bombings of July 11, 1975 in Mayagüez that took the lives of Puerto Rican workers. It is a continuous history of execution and of state terror waged against the entire population in Puerto Rico.
Ralph, this was not the first time that the FBI had tried to assassinate Filiberto Ojeda Rios. In 1983, when the FBI came to capture Ojeda Rios, and this was after he was indicted for a bank robbery that took place in Hartford, Connecticut, where $7.2 million was taken from a Wells Fargo truck. Only $80,000 of that was ever recaptured. And among the people that they sought, the macheteros, was Ojeda Rios. And the FBI sharpshooters had come upon him. And at that time, and this was in 1985 when they finally went to capture Ojeda Rios in reference to the Wells Fargo robbery, he shot warning shots from a machine gun, and they hit the wall and then ricocheted and hit an FBI agent in the face. At the time, the FBI was trying to not just capture him, but to kill him. He defended himself. He abandoned his attorneys and defended himself. In fact, the paralegal at the time became his wife, Elma, and he defended himself in court in Puerto Rico after he was accused by the U.S. government of trying to kill the FBI agent. Remarkably, the jurors all believed Ojeda Rios' version of the event. Now, I say remarkably because one would expect that the U.S. government would have tried all it could to get Ojeda Rios convicted of murder. And in fact, the events show the people understood the true nature of the event, that Ojeda Rios had acted in self-defense, and he was acquitted. As I said, this assassination was not the first attempt to murder this political leader.
The Orlando Sentinel, November 6, 2003. Puerto Rico files show FBI's zeal for decades. Secret U.S. dossiers target suspected. Tucked away amid 1.8 million pages the FBI has compiled on Puerto Rican activists during decades of surveillance, the hospital records of nationalist leader Pedro Albizu Campos, down to his nurses, daily notes on his heart rate, blood pressure, and his visits to the bathroom. Over 100 pages on the activities of a young man from the mountain town of Lares named Ramon Bosque Perez, who had protested the war in Vietnam. "I was a high school student. I wasn't even a senior," Bosque Perez stated. "It surprised me that it was relevant enough for the agency to open a file and devote considerable resources to investigating a high school student who is only just engaging in student political activity." Bosque Perez is working now to preserve the evidence of the federal government's long secret campaign to monitor, infiltrate, sabotage, and target lawful pro-independence movements and sympathizers throughout Puerto Rico. As a researcher at the Center for Puerto Rican Studies at New York's Hunter College, he has cataloged thousands of FBI documents from the 1930s to the 1990s for release on the Internet. Here are some of the revelations. FBI Director J. Edgar Hoover directed agents to plumb the personal files of all independistas. "We must have information concerning their weaknesses, morals, records, spouses, children, family life, personal activities, apart from any independence activity," Hoover stated in one memo. The agency maintained a list of suspects to be rounded up for custodial detention, a list that included Luis Muñoz Marin, the popular Democratic Party founder and a four-term governor. A psychological profile of Muñoz Marin diagnosed the governor as an intellectual with a bad case of Puerto Rican inferiority complex, as the racist J. Edgar Hoover. Indeed, as an enfeebled Albizu Campos lay dying in 1965, FBI agents were tapping the telephones of associates in an attempt to intercept his last words. "There are many lessons to be learned here about what was taking place," Bosque Perez stated. "There are lessons to be learned about what happens when you allow the state to take over and violate all rights nominally guaranteed by the Constitution." The Orlando Sentinel article is only the tip of the iceberg. The actual record of the FBI throughout this period is well documented here. It was setting up people for murder. It was targeting them for elimination. It was utilizing all of the dirty trick methods of the COINTELPRO program to foster false statements about people and to pit them against each other.
The FBI opened its first permanent office in San Juan, Puerto Rico in 1935. 1935, as long ago as that. And during the 1970s, the offices, as you mentioned in the introduction to our show, the offices of nationalist, pro-independence, and leftist organizations were bombed and members were assassinated. And as you also mentioned, there were these false flag operations and and the provocateur operations of getting people to initiate so-called terrorist acts. Individuals were subjected to surveillance, and eventually the people who know they were subjected to surveillance will be able to see their files at the Hunter College site. The Hunter College website for the Puerto Rico files is at www.pr-secretfiles.net. And right now on the website, they have the featured documents of Albizu Campos Pedro and Pedro Albizos Campos and Luis Munoz Marin, the individual files of leftists and also of the organizations are not yet mounted on the website. But you can submit your name, as I did, to their mailing list, and they will let you know when they are available, because they will have the FBI records of the various independence organizations. Ralph.
Maya, the article by Mireya Navarro in the New York Times on November 28th of 2003 expands upon this. New light on FBI fight, decades of surveillance of Puerto Rican groups. Federal agents leaned on the telephone company to speed up Albizu Campos' installation order for a telephone when they found that his family and friends sometimes used a neighbor's phone, and they tapped that one. And then the question was, what were they after? Current, precise information as to the condition of the subject. J. Edgar Hoover had given a specific and direct directive and stated that Albizu Campos was preparing to foment assassination attempts and other violence, and therefore he should be targeted himself for precisely that treatment. Now, the FBI files which were released are the result of Congressman Jose E. Serrano, who confronted FBI Director of the time, Louis J. Free, in a House Appropriations Subcommittee hearing. Serrano asked, what role did the FBI and federal agencies play in persecuting the independence movement? Was the FBI involved in specific violent acts? Did the FBI play a role in torturing leaders of the independence movement, specifically Pedro Albizu Campos, while he was in federal prison?
Yes, Ralph, because Campos insisted that he had been radiated by the U.S. government. And at the time, people were saying, oh, these are the ravings of a madman. But in fact, we know now, through revelations of FBI files, that the government did radiate prisoners. And Campos was not lying. He was tortured in prison.
Well, Maya, the FBI's own goals were, the goal is to disrupt the work of organizations, and they targeted, of course, not only the Puerto Rican independence movement, but labor organizations, the Black Panthers, Martin Luther King. It was a generalized assault on the rights of people across the United States. It was specifically focused, however, in Puerto Rico. When Free was confronted in the hearing, he acknowledged that, in fact, the agency had been involved in the following types of actions. People lost their lives. The authorities were involved in the loss of these lives. Serrano repeated this in a press release, acknowledging that, in fact, the FBI was involved in a campaign of targeted murder. The execution of Ojeda Rios is in this long tradition of the murder apparatus of the imperial state. In fact, as I mentioned, Luis Munoz Marin, the first elected governor of Puerto Rico, was specifically targeted and labeled a communist and someone who should be handled and, if necessary, removed. He was later, in no small measure because of the threats that he was aware of, brought to heel and became, in fact, an instrument of that very rule. That, however, is the pattern of the murder state. This is not an academic question here. The FBI files, 1.8 million documents, are replete with plans to eliminate people. This is a terror apparatus in which people are targeted if they are youngsters, if they are students, if they are trade union leaders, if they are sympathetic to the struggle for justice for workers and for women, let alone for the independence of Puerto Rico. They tracked the move of everybody in Puerto Rico, as Matthew Hay Brown reported on November 6, 2003. Decades of surveillance. pages and pages that pertain to people in every walk of life in Puerto Rico, many of them not to be heard from again, their fate never disclosed or understood. Obviously and clearly, from what is emerging here, they were executed. The federal government's long secret campaign to monitor, infiltrate, and sabotage the organizations and the individuals who were targeted in this fashion in Puerto Rico.
And Ralph, when some of the independence fighters are captured by the United States and they are imprisoned, they are given the longest sentences, far more than convicted criminals from the unfair U.S. justice system. The 11 Puerto Rican nationalists who were eventually provided clemency, not even a fair terms of clemency, but still clemency by President Clinton, had together a combined sentence of 200 years behind bars. All had been arrested as young men and women. One had been 19, and they emerged from the U.S. jails middle-aged. Juan Segura Palmer, who actually was another macheteros who had been with Ojeda Ritos, supposedly, in the Hartford bank robbery of 1983. He had had a 55-year sentence. These are nonviolent crimes. It was a robbery of which he was accused and convicted, and it was a 55-year sentence. These are very long terms. These are political statements to the people of Puerto Rico. Stay put. Do not oppose the U.S. in any way, shape, or form. So let's look at what has actually happened as a result of the assassination of Filiberto Ojeda Rios. He had been on the most wanted file of the FBI for more than a decade. On the FBI website of its most wanted fugitives, they list many aliases for Ojeda Rios. They were not able to locate him. This was one of their campaigns to not just get him, but to eliminate him. He had been a musician with trumpet and guitar before he embarked on his revolutionary career. And the FBI had put out rewards. Since 1999, it was a reward first of $500,000, and now we're told a reward of $1 million. And on their website, they say, should be considered armed and dangerous. The people of Puerto Rico didn't consider that Ojeda Rios was armed and dangerous. He has become a martyr, a hero. The governor, the head of the Catholic Church, everyone is incensed in Puerto Rico about the U.S. targeted assassination of Ojeda Rios. Well, this has led to a move on the part of FBI Director Robert S. Mueller III, who came out on the Monday after the Friday assassination to order an investigation of the shooting death of Filiberto Ojeda Rios. As the Hartford Courant reporter Edmund Mahoney wrote on September 27th, the FBI said Saturday the firefight began after agents located Ojeda Rios in a farmhouse in western town of Hormigueros, and that when the agents approached to serve an arrest warrant, the Bureau said, Ojeda Rios opened the front door and began firing. The Bureau said agents returned fire repeatedly but waited a day before entering the house, supposedly, they said, because they thought there might be explosives, that the house had been booby-trapped. Yet, as Ojeda Rios's wife stated and as the eyewitness, the neighbor, stated, the FBI fired first, and that a bullet wound from the sharpshooter, as Ralph mentioned, went under his collarbone, through the shoulder, pierced a lung, and exited the back. The blood that flowed from Ojeda Rios, by the way, could be seen outside the front door of the little home that Ojeda Rios had built for himself. The FBI's website includes the press release of Mueller. FBI director asks for independent review. It will be, it states here, reviewing the circumstances surrounding the wounding of an FBI agent and the death of Filiberto Ojeda Rios. And we will see what sort of independent investigation is carried out. We don't expect it'll be much of an independent investigation by the Inspector General. It'll be another cover-up, much as the Warren Report or any of the investigations into assassinations in the United States.
Well,
by the United States.
One of the hallmarks of these official fictions is that, for example, at the 1975 hearings of Frank Church, the senator from Idaho, which disclosed assassination across the board as a matter of official policy.
This is Taking Aim with
Ralph Schoenman
and Maya Schoen. Our program today, Execution in Puerto Rico, the Signature of U.S. Rule. Ralph?
Well, Maya, I was mentioning the hearings of Frank Church in 1975 on CIA assassination and official assassination, not only of foreign heads of state, but of dissidents and of opponents of U.S. policy in every part of the world. And at the time, you had the various mea culpas and the statements that this, of course, was the terrible past and that the lessons have been learned. And you may gauge this by the response of Louis Freeh, the then FBI director, to Congressman Serrano when Serrano confronted him, in fact caught him off guard, with documents that he had obtained about the directives of J. Edgar Hoover to disrupt the activity and compromise the effectiveness of individuals and to target them, and Freeh made the following statement. Your question goes back to a period when the FBI did operate a program that caused specific destruction to many people. Specific destruction to many people, Louis Freeh stated. He said that he would make these files available and see if we can redress the egregious illegal actions and criminal actions that occurred in the past. Criminal actions that occurred in the past. Destruction of individuals. Criminal actions. Here you have the head of the FBI confronted with documents and acknowledging that the FBI was engaged in the physical elimination of people and in criminal conduct with the color of authority. Discovery of the particular files caused the public outcry throughout the 1980s in Puerto Rico, prompted hundreds of civil rights lawsuits, and they obtained even an official apology from Governor Pedro J. Rosello, who set up a fund to compensate those who were harassed and targeted and harmed as a consequence of this FBI program. One of the subjects was Ramon Bosque Perez, as we mentioned, the sociologist and researcher who's now leading the effort at the Hunter Center to preserve the FBI historical trove. He is one of the authors of a 1997 book on the Puerto Rico police dossiers known as Carpetas. And indeed, what we have here is the feds revealing a dirty war, as Juan Gonzalez reported in New York Daily News on May 23rd, 2000, a dirty war, a secret war against Puerto Rican dissidents for over 40 years, a secret campaign of surveillance, disruption, and repression. Only now is part of the story coming out. And these series of articles, and of course we have to point out, we're talking about, officially acknowledged, over 2 million documents pertaining to these activities. Exactly 8,600 pages have been disgorged. What is the percentage of 8,600 as opposed to 2 million? You may get some inkling of what really, in fact, is the magnitude of this death squad operation, this execution program, this sustained campaign against dissidents, against opponents, against people exercising their democratic rights, not only in Puerto Rico, but in the United States, of course, and in all parts of the world. And Serrano sent the FBI files, not only with these particular revelations, but pertaining to the persecution of people in the student movement, the FUPI. There's a whole section on FUPI. These are youngsters, students at university, all of whom were targeted for their presence at a meeting, for their presence at a demonstration, and followed throughout their lives with these files and with reprisal action specifically mandated by the Federal Bureau of Investigation.
Ralph, this was part of COINTELPRO. It is, was rampant in the United States. It still goes on. We've discussed on Taking Aim the attacks, even against Clark Kerr, the president of the University of California system, and the collaboration of reporters with these COINTELPRO operations. This has been, according to Frey, this was the dark history of the FBI, but in fact it is the current history of the intelligence operations, not just of the FBI, but of police agencies throughout the United States, and this has been disclosed as happening in the anti-war movement currently as we speak.
Well, let me tell you, Maya, we all have our war stories, but a particular couple of incidents comes to mind, because at the time that I was Secretary General of the International Tribunal on United States War Crimes in Indochina, I was coordinating investigating teams that were going to Cambodia and to Laos and to the liberated zones of South Vietnam and North Vietnam itself in the carrying out of our investigation of the genocidal crimes of U.S. imperialism. I drove my car to Heathrow Airport at the time en route to Paris, where we were to coordinate a trip onto Phnom Penh. I was summoned by a phone call into an area of the airport which was a security area, and there I had a gun put to my head. And indeed, the outcome of that story is that while I was being held and didn't return, Jean-Paul Sartre called a press conference. It was the press conference which created a bit of a firestorm in the bourgeois press in France at the time, and I was in fact released. It was not the intention. My car was at Heathrow. One of my colleagues had gone to pick up my car since I was going to be gone for weeks, and as he drove it on the freeway from Heathrow into London, suddenly the wheel was like a toy kiddie car in an amusement park. He somehow managed to avoid an accident, let alone a fatal one. The linkage between the steering column and the wheels had been neatly severed. COINTELPRO is not an academic exercise. Anybody who's been involved in the struggle can give their own personal experience of that.
Now back to Puerto Rico and the U.S. assault against it. Puerto Rico, the Last Colony, is an important article that appeared in the International Socialist Review, written by Hector Reyes, and it was written in the winter of 1997 as the feature of International Socialist Review, issue number 3. It is available on the website at www.isreview.org. I suggest you look at it. It's a long article because we cannot discuss all the features of the political ramifications of the Puerto Rican independence struggle. Puerto Rico, the Last Colony. You have to remember that Puerto Rico was taken from Spain in 1898, and in 1917, all island residents were given U.S. citizenship. But Puerto Rico itself has a very strange status, as eventually was called a commonwealth, where the residents of Puerto Rico can come to the United States and function as U.S. citizens. And in fact, almost half the Puerto Rican population has migrated, and some of this is a forced migration that we may not have time to discuss today, to the United States, and 3.7 million people remain on the island. It's a small island. It's 35 miles by 110 miles long, smaller than the state of Connecticut. As I said, 3.7 million people reside now in Puerto Rico. Half of them live in the capital, San Juan, and its suburbs. The economy of Puerto Rico has changed drastically over the years from an agricultural to an industrial economy, but a certain type of industrial economy, a sort of test case of the maquiladoras. Puerto Rico became a main exporter of rum since the 19th century, and 83% of the rum sold on the U.S. mainland comes from Puerto Rico, and this derives from the sugarcane industry, which was imposed upon the island and imposed by U.S. large landholders and corporations. Part of the sequence of the development of Puerto Rico has to do with the tax structure, the tax codes, which first made it possible for the development movement of the clothing industry, the movement of the clothing industry from northeast of the United States to the south, and then with tax concessions to the island of Puerto Rico. But as low-cost labor throughout the Caribbean and China and Mexico, where there were lower wages because Puerto Rico is tied to the minimum wage structure of the United States, the garment industry fled from Puerto Rico, but the United States made it easy for capital-intensive industries such as the pharmaceutical industry to develop in Puerto Rico with preferential tax breaks, some of which came to an end this year. And let's look at this, because the study of the pharmaceutical industry and most of the major pharmaceuticals used in the United States are produced in Puerto Rico. 52 drugs account for half of the Puerto Rican sales, and they are produced by 9 of the major U.S. pharmaceutical companies. Drugs such as Lipitor and other heart and cholesterol drugs are made in Puerto Rico. Half of all U.S.-made pacemakers are made in Puerto Rico. Ralph.
Well, Maya, the Puerto Rico Herald, in its Journal of Commerce, published a piece on June 1st, 2003, called The Dawn of a New Day by Alan M. Field. This is the Commonwealth Business Media, and he writes as follows. Lured by rock-bottom corporate income taxes that max out at 7% and economic incentives for research and development, Fortune 500 companies have turned the island into a paradise of high-margin, high-tech manufacturing. Exports of pharmaceuticals tripled from $8.3 billion in fiscal 1997 to $28.6 billion in fiscal 2001. 16 of the top 20 pharmaceutical products are made on the island, as are half of all U.S.-made pacemakers. Quote, lots of low-wage companies left Puerto Rico and moved to the Dominican Republic, said David E. Lewis, vice president of Manchester Trade Limited, a trade advisory firm in Washington. But the high-end, high-value manufacturers of pharmaceuticals and high-tech have stayed. And indeed, William Reefcall, executive vice president of the Puerto Rican Manufacturers Association, said the reason is simple. American companies find Puerto Rico a very profitable location. Good human resources, incredible tax incentives. Now, let me refer here, Maya. You cited the piece by called The Puerto Rico, The Last Colony, which is by Hector Reyes, and it's an article. It's an extended piece, which I recommend. It's the International Socialist Review issue of winter 1997, and it is, I think, a very cogent and manifestly documented demonstration of what the colonial nature of Puerto Rico is really about. And in this piece, Hector Reyes makes the following observation. Puerto Rico ceased to be an agricultural economy in the 1950s. In 1993, more than 68% of workers were involved in manufacturing, services, government, or construction. Fewer than 3% were agricultural workers. The native indigenous agriculture had been destroyed. Puerto Rico remains a very poor country, plagued by unemployment and low wages. The standard of living of the Puerto Rican working class is significantly lower than that of the United States working class. In 1996, the average manufacturing wage was 60% of that paid in the United States, many people earning the minimum wage. And indeed, Puerto Rico's per capita income was one-third of the United States, half of that of Mississippi. And the cost of living was at least 25% higher than that of the United States.
Ralph, as an aside, 44% of Puerto Ricans live in poverty. And the poverty level, as calculated by the Puerto Rican government, is half that of how the Census Bureau in the United States calculates poverty level. And poverty level in the United States, the FPL, is now at a little more than $19,000 for a family of four. So that means in Puerto Rico, they are calculating poverty level at about $10,000 for a family of four. And they say that 44% of their population is living, a family of four living on less than $5,000 a year.
Well, here's how it's described in the last colony. The official figures for unemployment were 23%. What are the real figures? Because they don't, as soon as someone stops looking for a job, it's rather like in the United States, they no longer calculate it in the statistics. The real, I'm quoting, the real rate is over 30% in the towns, and in the central regions of Puerto Rico, the unemployment rates are 75%. 75% unemployment in the interior, over 30% in the towns. The combination of low wages, unemployment, underemployment has compelled a significant portion of the Puerto Rican population to flee. A significant increase in the pauperization of the population of Puerto Rico. That is a permanent condition. That is a deepening condition. That is the colonization of Puerto Rico in its essence and the meaning of imperial rule.
Out. They were helped on their way also. It was not by choice that they were fleeing. Muñoz Marin, the four-time governor, who at first was investigated by the FBI and then entered into a long collaboration with first the Franklin Delano Roosevelt administration and then further administrations as he moved through four terms as governor. In the second half of the 1940s, with his PPD party, they focused on granting full tax exemption to U.S. corporations to encourage them to set up in Puerto Rico. But then his government also, quote, unofficially sponsored the migration of Puerto Ricans to the United States. The PPD had decided it wanted to ship out as many as 1 million workers, unemployed, or former peasants at a time when Puerto Rico had a population of barely 2 million people. That is, over a period of 10 years, they intended to depopulate the island by one half. The third and the most insidious part of this campaign, and it was a campaign supported by the Rockefellers, John D. Rockefeller III, and his foundation for population control, was the massive sterilization campaign that was fully supported by the U.S. government and the ruling powers and the ruling rich in the United States. By 1981, 32.5% of all Puerto Rican women between the ages of 15 to 49 were sterilized. And if you look at some of the younger childbearing ages, it's almost 50%, 48.4% of the sexually active, either married or cohabitating, were sterilized. That is, when they went into the hospital, particularly for giving birth to a child, they were pressured by doctors. They were encouraged to have tubal ligations or hysterectomies to be sterilized. 32.5% of all women, but of those most sexually active, almost 50%, 48.4% were sterilized.
But Maya, the CWLU, which is a women's rights labor organization in Chicago, in its disclosure, a hitherto secret report from an economic policy group empowered by the government of Puerto Rico that surfaced in the United States, kept from the public, it speaks openly about the reduction of the work of the ranks of the Puerto Rican working class. What is the nature of this forced sterilization? Every woman who has gone into a hospital in pregnancy had her tubes tied without her knowledge or consent. This was a policy imposed from the United States and enacted in Puerto Rican hospitals so that, as you say, the numbers of women who were in hospital for birth and who were then having their tubes tied reached to a point where almost 50% of the population was indeed massively sterilized, overwhelmingly working class women. This is a policy of design. It is a genocidal policy. When William Bennett so famously and recently declares that if you want to reduce the crime rate in New Orleans, you should abort every black child. These are not the midnight ramblings of a marginal figure. These are the explicit description of the policies that the Rockefeller Institute has designed since the 20s and 30s, that the Center for Disease Control has implemented across suffering Africa, that the vaccination programs of the World Health Organization have manifested with the manufacture of viruses that are, in fact, laboratory creations, mutated viruses that are immune system resistant, from Marburg to Ebola. We've done a six-part series on the subject. Puerto Rico was a hothouse laboratory for the sterilization and genocidal attack upon the working class and the poor.
And also, Puerto Rico was a center for pharmaceutical research. The birth control pill, from the mid-1950s to the early 1960s, in the remote farming towns in the foothills of Puerto Rico, particularly in Puerto Rico's east coast, in the town of Humacao, Puerto Rico was one of these rural towns. Experiments were taking place on the birth control pill, Inovid, the early pill, and others. And they were given out free to hundreds of women. In fact, 6,000 women were tested over a number of years, and some of them some died. There are reports of two women who were healthy dying in the field trials that took place in Humacao, and others may have died elsewhere. Puerto Rico was the testing ground. Women didn't know that they were participating. They were told it was, quote, a magic pill. And in these remote farming towns, the pharmaceutical companies were using these human guinea pigs without informed consent, just as in Africa today, they do this with the African population. Ralph,
well, Maya,
to conclude.
Well, we're going to have to do a further program on this, because the discussion about the why the U.S. holds on to this colony and what they really exact and extract from the people of Puerto Rico is an essential one. No less is a discussion about the putative lack of support for independistas and the call for independence in Puerto Rico. It has a very specific content, i.e., the Puerto Rican independence movement cannot separate itself from the struggle for capture of control of the economy. The question of the independence of Puerto Rico is the question of its emancipation from capitalism. When Che Guevara, in 1964, in Algiers, at an international conference addressing the question of the mechanism of imperial control, Che stated, "The moving of troops across frontiers is not the fundamental cause of exploitation nor the imperial mode of subjugation. It is merely the tactic and mechanism of coercion. The fundamental operation is that of the market that exacts resources for nothing and cheap labor wherever it can." He stated liberating Cuba was a worthy thing to do, but it was rather like liberating Poughkeepsie. Here we are, 5 million people locked within a sea of corporate capital. If, he said, we conceive of our socialism as no more than integrating our island within the world capitalist economy, we can only do that at the expense of 300 million people in Latin America. The struggle for socialism in Cuba, said Che, was the struggle for its extension to Latin America and beyond. And Che was a man who argued by example, the struggle in Puerto Rico cannot be separated from the emancipation of people from capitalist control. It is not only the island of Puerto Rico. It is not only the Caribbean. The struggle for the Puerto Rican people and for the emancipation from assassination and subjugation and colonial control has to do with the worldwide struggle, the integrated struggle of a working class mobilizing against their capitalist masters. Nothing short of that, brothers and sisters. And indeed, we will continue with the Puerto Rican people and the way forward in programs to come.
We would like to thank Bob Lederer for suggesting today's program. And Bob produced a special, 11 o'clock on last Thursday, that is available on the WBAI archive with an interview of Segura Palmer. I suggest you listen to it. Execution in Puerto Rico, the signature of U.S. rule, will be on our website, our program archive, www.takingaim.info, as well as the new WBAI archive. I want to mention that next week we start on Wednesday starts the WBAI fund drive, and I hope you will save some of your premium support for next next Tuesday when we have a three-hour special. We will begin at 3 o'clock from 3 to 6 with a very interesting program. We are going to have a dialogue, an interview with Joan Mellon. Joan is the author of a new book,
A Farewell to Justice, Maya. A Farewell to Justice is the culmination of 7 years of investigative work in which Joan continued the investigation inaugurated by Jim Garrison and has come home with the evidence, interviewing over 1,000 people, locating witnesses, surfacing the documents, the Central Intelligence Agency's role in the execution of John Kennedy, the meaning of the Kennedy execution, the significance of the Garrison investigation, the red-handed caught Central Intelligence Agency at the top involvement in the execution of a president, the subject matter of A Farewell to Justice. It's a seminal book. We'll be discussing it with Joan and its implications not only for the United States, but for everyone in the world.